All right, A.J. Ayer is a logical positivist. How does he differ from a positivist? Logical positivism developed the principle of empirical verifiability, and they use that to test all meaningful statements, whereas just plain positivists didn't have that. The life of Ayer, British, graduate of Oxford, 1932, part of Vienna Circle of logical positivism in the early 30s, that included Schlick, Feigl, Carnap. He's been president of the British Humanist Society. His writings, and the most important one, Language, Truth, and Logic. He tried to eliminate metaphysics via verifiability. Foundations of Empirical Knowledge deals with problems of private language and other minds. Philosophical Essays, articles treating problems raised by the first two books. The Problem of Knowledge reflects moderate anti-skeptical realism, accepts some statements may be true even if they can't be justified in principle. In fact, Ayer had a very interesting experience a few years ago. It's been written up. He had a near-death experience. Now, here he is, for all practical purposes, an atheist, humanist atheist, doesn't believe in God, doesn't believe in life after death, and he had a near-death experience and lived. And so he wrote an article and he said, I have come to believe now in the possibility of life after death. God, no, but maybe immortality. So now he needs a near-God experience, and maybe he'll come to believe in God. Major influences on Ayer. David Hume's empiricism. How did Hume end the inquiry concerning human understanding? Search all the books in the world, ask two questions. Is it true by definition? Did it come from one or more of the five senses? If it didn't, throw it in the flames. That statement becomes the principle of empirical verifiability. That's what it means. To be meaningful, a statement must be either A, true by definition, or two, known from one or more of the five senses. If it isn't true by definition, tautology, or known from the senses, it is not meaningful. It's not saying that it doesn't refer to anything, he's just saying it's not meaningful. If it's not meaningful, it couldn't be true either, because all true statements are meaningful. A meaningful statement is either true or false. So Ayer is laying down a principle which, if applied, would eliminate all God talk. That's why I call this view a-cognosticism. That is a term I coined and have used for years in the books on it, a-cognosticism, because there is no cognitive knowledge of God. It's not the same as agnosticism. An agnostic says, I can't know God. An a-cognostic says, you can't talk meaningfully about God. There's a difference. The atheist says, I know there is no God. The skeptic says, I don't know if there is a God. The agnostic says, I don't know or I can't know if there's a God. But the cognostic says, that's not a meaningful question to me, whether you can know or not know there's a God. It's whether or not it's meaningful to talk about him, and I say it's not meaningful to talk about him. So atheist, I know there is no God. Agnostic, I don't know there is a God. And the a-cognostic is not meaningful to talk about it. There's a whole religious school of thought that arose in the 60s on this. Paul Van Buren, called semantical atheism. At this point, it may be helpful for me to describe the different senses of the term God is dead. What does this mean to different people? Well, there are different schools of modern thought. You could say God is dead actually, and that, of course, would be traditional atheism. God is dead actually. Sartre would hold that, and Camus and others. You could say God died. God is dead mythologically. That is, that there was once a live myth that God lived, and this myth died. That would be Nietzsche. That the myth once lived, and people used to live by this myth, but that myth died, and people can no longer live by it. Nietzsche didn't believe that God really lived, and then he died. He believed that the myth died. Or you could say God died dialectically. That is, he died in the process of history, and that is the view of Altizer. That was the so-called death of God movement. And I want to pause to explain that. What Altizer meant is there actually was a God, and he actually was up there. And then he actually came down here. And when Christ came, when God came down in the incarnation, he left heaven. I mean, he takes us all rather literally to understand it. There was a literal God up there, and that literal God up there literally came down here, and that literally left heaven empty. So God died transcendentally or transcendently, and God now is immanent. Then when Christ came, what did he do? He died on the cross. So God died in the incarnation itself. God died on the cross, and there is no resurrection. And then God died in modern times when man finally figured out what happened there. From 1800 to the present, God has died in modern times. So you really have kind of several stages to the death of God. But there was actually a God who actually once lived, and he died in this dialectical process. Then fourth, when did he live and teach? In the 60s. It was very hot. One nice thing about the death of God movement is it died fast. Yeah, he taught at Emory. And he's still alive and teaching. God died, but Altizer's alive. Number four is that God died semantically. And this would be Eyre, and then, of course, Van Buren, and the other semantical cog Gnostics. God died semantically. People used to think it made sense to talk about God. But then when we start analyzing, what makes sense? The only thing that makes sense is tautologies, 2 plus 2 is 4. God doesn't fit in that category. Or empirical statements. God is not known through your empirical senses. So it doesn't make sense to talk about God. God is literally nonsense. Someone has said that the history, the best description of the 20th century is it's the century of atheism. If you take atheism in the broadest sense of the term, up to maybe about 10 years ago, that's true. Now I'd say pantheism with the rise of the New Age movement. But we went from a theistically oriented Western world to, let's say, 1900 when Nietzsche died and pronounced the death of God. And then from 1900 on, maybe even earlier, 1859 when Darwin wrote, somewhere between 1859 1900 on, God's death became obvious in Europe first. We're a little slower here. It takes time to get over the water. And then it got over here a generation later, and now the death of God has pretty well died out, and the birth of Eastern religions and pantheism. Harvey Cox wrote the book The Turn East, and so from, say, about the 60s, in the United States anyway, from the 60s on, we've got the rebirth of pantheism, and it's still growing, and I think it'll be the dominant movement, certainly of the first part of the 21st century, as far as we can see. Yes, if you think of him as an atheist, I think of him as a developmental pantheist, you remember. But pantheism and atheism are flip sides, and his students, Feuerbach and others, became atheists, so there's a half-truth to that. All right, let's go to A.J. Eyre then and find out what semantical atheism is and why they held it. Two, the philosophy of Eyre. Now, we're talking about early A.J. Eyre. The late A.J. Eyre has repented of this. The criterion of verifiability, all genuine propositions, declarative statements, must be empirically testable, or else they are purely formal or definitional. There are only three types of propositions: analytic, truisms, tautologies, true by definition. They're just explicative, or synthetic, true by experience, and or in relation to experience. They're ampliative. Or thirdly, nonsensical, meaningless, no literal significance at all. They're emotive at best. They have three kinds of propositions: analytic, synthetic, and nonsensical. True by definition, true from the senses, or literally nonsense. And the only thing significance you can give to the third category is they may be emotive. They may ejaculate a feeling. That's what emotive means. It may express a feeling. For example, Ayer says all ethical statements are emotive. And we'll take a look at that. When I say thou shalt, I really mean I don't like that, and I don't want you to like it either. When I say thou shalt not kill, I'm really saying I don't like killing, and I hope you don't like it either. That's emotive. I'm emoting and trying to influence your feeling toward it. Kant rejected metaphysics on different grounds. Kant said, as a matter of fact, the mind cannot go beyond the phenomena of the physical world, but it must go beyond in order to know it cannot go beyond. Hence, Kant had a metaphysic. Ayer held, as a matter of logic, that we cannot speak meaningfully of what may be beyond the empirical. As Wittgenstein said, this is the last line of his famous Tractatus, that whereof you cannot speak, speak not thereof. The impossibility of metaphysics rests not in the psychology of man, but in the meaning of language. And then he made some distinctions, the verifiability principle, the difference between practical and principial verification, practical verification, propositions that we have the means to verify, and principial propositions that we don't have the means to verify. For example, there is no life in Mars, is verifiable in principle, though not yet in practice. The difference between strong and weak verification, only weak verification is valid. Strong verification means certitude beyond doubt, conclusive proof. We don't have that. Weak verification, subject to change or correction since it's based on experience. Conclusion, no proposition other than a tautology, 2 + 2 = 4, can be more than probable. All men are mortal is either purely definitional, that is, man means mortal and mortal means man, or is an empirical generalization that we only have probable knowledge from. Further refinement of the verifiability principle. No proposition can be conclusively confuted by experience any more than it can be conclusively verified by experience. Analytic propositions cannot be either verified or falsified by experience. How do you verify I am I? 2 + 2 = 4 by experience. You can't do it. Propositions don't have to be directly verifiable to be meaningful, but it must have some sense experience related to its truth or falsity. And then two revisions of the verifiability principle in his introduction to the 1946 edition. Some definitional propositions, for example, the verifiability principle, are meaningful without being either factual or purely arbitrary. Now that's very interesting, and I can tell you a story that happened to me. I was taking philosophy in a school whose professor was teaching this back in the 60s. And the professor was a very mod professor, and he decided that the class should be taught by the students. Said, who would like to take chapter one and teach that next time? So I raised my hand for chapter one. Who would like to take chapter two? Somebody, chapter two. Well, chapter one was the verifiability principle. So I got up to give the lecture, and I said, here's what Ayer teaches. Something to be meaningful has to be true by definition or empirically verifiable. This principle of empirical verifiability is neither true by definition nor empirically verifiable, therefore it's meaningless. Wow! The professor was absolutely irate because he believed that, but it had never occurred to him. That critique had never occurred to him. This was destroying the class from day one because he was going to build on this. That one day he came in class and he used to sit on a chair, and there was a platform there, and there was a little space about that big between the platform and the wall. His chair was all the way over toward that crack, and one leg was in the crack. And he looked at that, and he looked out at me and said, Geisler, did you do that? He was even paranoid about me. thought I put his chair in the crack to get rid of him. At any rate, what happened to the principle of empirical verifiability is this very thing. It died death by qualification. Because Ayer sooner or later realized himself that, hey, what am I going to do with my principle of empirical verifiability? It's not empirically verifiable, and it's not true by definition. So I got to create a third status for it. So they started talking about meta-linguistic statements and third kind of statements, and pretty soon, before they knew it, what they had excluded out the front door was coming in the back door, because once you make a third kind of statement, why can't I have a third kind of statement and say there are statements about God that might be meaningful that aren't empirically verifiable, and the whole thing sooner or later died, and I'd say by the 70s at least, the late 60s, even the people who were in the original circle were fading out, and I think only Carnap is left. I don't think there's a logical positivist left because they have all seen the error of their way. Well, D, if it were true, metaphysical propositions would all be nonsensical because they're not analytical or empirical. Genuine philosophy is not metaphysical but analytical, they would say. Metaphysics arose by accident of language, namely the belief that some nouns have real reference. Metaphysics is not merely misplaced poetry. Poetry does not talk nonsense. There's a literal meaning behind most of what poetry says, not so for metaphysics. And for our purpose, no meaningful propositions can be formulated about God or a transcendent. This is neither atheism nor agnosticism, both of which hold it is meaningful to speak about God. This is non-cognitivism, which holds the very question of God to be meaningless. Now let's apply this to ethics. Ethical statements are neither formal nor factual, but emotive. They express the speaker's feeling and attempt to persuade others to feel that way. You ought not steal means I dislike it and I want you to dislike it. Ethical statements are not factually declarative, but merely expressive of the speaker's attitude. Ethical statements are not statements about one's feelings, but of one's feelings. They're statements of your feelings, not statements about your feelings. Hence, this view is subjective, but not radically subjectivistic, Ehr claims. They are merely ejaculative statements, hence unverifiable, whereas statements about feeling are verifiable. For example, I am bored is verifiable, but a sigh is not. I feel pain is verifiable, I feel physical pain, but ouch is not. Ouch is just an emotive expression. All ethical statements are like ouch statements. They have no prescriptive value at all. Note, Ehr has subsequently abandoned logical positivism, but not his agnosticism about God, though a near-death experience in late 1980s made him more open to a belief in the afterlife. Okay, any question about logical positivism or what it means?
In that view, is it, for example, looking at how he doesn't accept verifiable things, if he was in a car accident, two witnesses saw it, would he call in those witnesses? Because
yeah.
Even though they were witnesses who would verifiably, but it can't be verifiable?
No, it's verifiable in principle and in practice. Some things are only verifiable in principle, like there's life on the other side of Mars. It's verifiable in principle, but in practice we can't quite get there and explore it yet. But an accident is verifiable in principle and in practice because you can have people actually see it and empirically verify their eyes, their senses, so forth. History is the same thing. Verifiable indirectly through witnesses that the event happened, but a miracle, no, but history in general, yes. Synthetic propositions are empirical propositions. Synthetic means that the predicate adds to the concept of the subject. See, an analytic proposition, the predicate says the same thing as the subject. Subject is husband. So let's say all husbands are in the category of unmarried men. That's an analytic statement. All husbands are in the category of unmarried men. But unmarried men means exactly the same as husband. It doesn't add anything to husband. But if you say the man is in a category of a tall person, this man, let's make it, this man is in the category of a tall person. Now obviously tall adds something to man because he could be short and still be man. Tall is not part of his humanness, his manness. So when the predicate rather adds, and in logic this is the subject, This is the copula or connective, and this is the predicate. It's not the same as in the English grammar, but the subject is about which something is being affirmed. The copula is the is or is not. The connective and the predicate is what is being affirmed about it. So the predicate in this case doesn't add, and the predicate in this case adds, so this equals synthetic, and this equals analytic. Now that's conclusively confuted by experience. He didn't say he didn't say it's not meaningful, and he didn't say you couldn't even know it was true. He just said you couldn't absolutely refute it.
Where'd all the logical positivists go after they?
Where have all the flowers gone? Error is converted to a moderate realist now, and agnostic, open to afterlife. Feigl became a realist, taught at University of Minnesota. Carnap remains one, and Schlick, I don't know. Okay, that raises a question. I was leafing through my notes to see if I could find it, but I couldn't. What is still alive in this movement is what we could call more broadly confirmability or disconfirmability. While their principle was far too narrow, we can't leave things totally open that can't be proven or disproven some way, and that led to a very important article by Anthony Flew, and a very important parable that we need to add to our notes. I don't see it here, and so we need to add him at this point, stick him before Wittgenstein. Anthony Flew came up with something that taunted philosophers for a whole decade or more, almost 20 years. He invented a parable which he got from John Wisdom that goes like this. And it's the flip side of verifiability, which is called falsifiability. And he said, in order for something to be meaningful, it must be falsifiable. I mean, if you can't disprove a theory, it's a meaningless theory. I mean, you just offer a theory in science, and there's no way to prove or disprove it, scientists won't accept it. I mean, you're just whistling Dixie, you're just spinning theories out of your own imagination. And Flew said, let me give you an example of what I think is wrong with believers, what I think is wrong with Christians. They have something that they believe is true, but you couldn't disprove it under any circumstances. They say God exists or God is loving. Let's take the statement, God is loving. And you go to a believer and you say, how could I falsify that? Under what conditions would you cease believing God is loving? And I show them all the evil in the world. I tell them about Hitler and the Holocaust, and say, well, you know, God is loving, but he has his purposes through evil, and Hitler was ultimately defeated, and he's going to ultimately triumph. Well, even the Holocaust won't falsify God is loving. And I say, well, what if God struck your wife with cancer and she died? And, well, his ways are mysterious. His love I don't always understand, but no, that wouldn't falsify my love. And then finally, the atheist throws up his hands in despair and says, well, look, save me some time. Just tell me, what would have to happen so that you would no longer believe in the statement, God is love? Give me some condition somewhere that would falsify your faith. He said, belief in God is literally unfalsifiable. And if it's unfalsifiable, it's meaningless. And that parable and that illustration had theists scurrying around for 10 or 20 years in all sorts of directions. It was called the principle of falsifiability, which is the flip side of verifiability. And there was a whole book written on it and volumes written on it. And there were a number of alternatives that came out of it. John Hick said, I can tell you how you can do it. There are some things, he said, first of all, there is no symmetrical relationship between verifiability and falsifiability. Some things are verifiable but that aren't falsifiable. For example, my own immortality, that there is a soul that survives death. I can verify that, because if someday I look down and there's my corpse in a casket, there's my wife over there in black and she's crying, and the kids are sitting there, and then there's a hearse out there, and I'm still conscious, and I'm alive and conscious, but I see my funeral going on, I just verified immortality. I lived on, and yet I died. But you can't falsify immortality, because you wouldn't be there. There'd be no way to falsify it. How do you falsify the statement that you don't exist after death? He says, so some things are verifiable that aren't falsifiable, so don't push this falsification principle too far. Furthermore, said John Hick, I can verify whether there's a God, because if someday I die and I meet an ultimate being, feel ultimate bliss and joy, and have interpersonal, absolutely perfect communion, I verified God. That's eschatological verification. Now, with that in mind, let me give you the three directions that people went after this verification, falsification dilemma. They either said you can verify it from the past, you can verify Christianity in the present, or you can verify it in the future. John Hick went with future or eschatological verification, just as we said. If you die and you're still conscious, you verified immortality. If you have this ultimate fulfillment experience with God, you verified him. There are others who said, no, you can verify it historically, and that's basically Christian apologists like John Warwick Montgomery, Gary Haber Mass, Josh McDowell. You look into the historical evidence for Christianity that Christ claimed to live, die, rise from the dead, and you have a historical verification of the truth of Christianity. That's the proof. What would disprove it then, to flip over? Well, if they found the body of Christ, if they found that all the witnesses were false, that would falsify it. So there are ways to falsify it. Paul said, if he didn't rise, we've all been most miserable, Christianity is a lie, etc. So you can either go to past historical verification, future eschatological verification, or basically present experiential verification, and that's people like Ian Ramsey, the English scholar, who said, there is a way to verify whether it is a religious experience, or Paul Tillich. Is it an ultimate commitment to the ultimate? Am I having a valid experience of God? And they just use experiential arguments to verify that God exists because I have experienced him and I can talk meaningfully about him in models or metaphors. So these people just took the bull by the horn and said there is some truth to verification, falsification, but it's not as narrow as empirical verification. So it's broader, and you might use the word confirmation or disconfirmation to get away from the narrow connotations. But your question, the implication of your question is absolutely right. There's got to be some way to prove or disprove, confirm or disprove. Otherwise, you can make any kind of wild claim, and there's no way to test it.